morning, church. It's times like this, I wish I had a more unique name. You now have John preaching from John about John. So there was a man sent from God whose name was John. I'll do my best. I want to start out this morning with some gratitude. I didn't come forward a couple weeks ago as we had a testimony Sunday, but I do feel the need to just express publicly, and this is, I think, my chance before the end of the year to really thank this congregation. This past year has been a very big year for me personally, and it's been a very transformational year. I feel like every year is a transformational year with this church, but especially these past 12 months. It was last January that, through the guidance of this church, I proposed and got engaged to Sulgi. We got married in May, just 4 months later, with the help of this. Thank you. with the support and help of this entire congregation. I mean, it was just truly a church wedding, a family wedding, and we had such a blast. And since then, we're living now 4 houses away from the church in the Fink House. We've been doing construction on that with a lot of your help there. We started Underground Seminary, Pastor Jen and I and Laura, and we're just having a blast with the students. And so right now, my entire life is wrapped up in this community, in this congregation, from morning until night when we wake up and we're doing classes and teaching, having meals together, seeing and spending time with all of you, and then coming here on Sunday to worship and celebrate with you as well. I can say that the way that I understand the world, the way that I understand myself, that I see things around me, has been completely turned around, and I'm very grateful to you for that, and I'm grateful to be so embraced by this community. So I just want to start with that, since I haven't had a chance to express that publicly recently. It's with that background and the journey we've been on as a congregation over this past year, this past several years, and the learning that I've experienced with Underground Seminary as well, as an extension of our church's ministry, that I approach this text today. And I wrestle with the question of Advent. What did Advent, the coming of the Messiah, mean for the Jewish people at this time? What does it mean for us today? And what is going on here in this text in the Gospel of John as we open it up? This is the testimony given by John when the Jews sent priests and Levites from Jerusalem to ask him, "Who are you? Who do you think you are?" There is a long history in the church of grappling with the way that the Jews are portrayed in the Gospel of John. I've got a little more clarity, I think, on that now as I've gone back to the text and with some of our historical study in the seminary. We've spent a lot of our time focusing on the rise of civilization vis-a-vis indigenous hunter-gatherer societies that started happening approximately 10,000 years ago. With the rise of agriculture, you start to have food surplus. You start to have storage, and then you need people to protect your storage. You need police, but it allows for the chance, because you're not looking for food every day, for more specialized jobs, tasks to begin to emerge. Around the Fertile Crescent, Mesopotamia, eventually down into Egypt and through Palestine, the region now known as Palestine, this had been happening for the thousands of years leading up until this point. You start to have the rise of cities that are drawn from the countryside all around, and that are drawn the surpluses of the countryside into the cities. And so cities emerge, and shortly after the rise of cities, you finally have the rise of empires, of kingdoms, of some people who have found a way to take advantage of this newfound surplus through agriculture and exploiting the countryside and bringing it into the city center. We see, coming up until the time of the New Testament, Israel has now grappled with a number of the rise and fall of empires around them. There's been Egypt, Assyria, Babylon, Persia, Greece, and now Rome. Every one posing different challenges, difficulties, but everyone challenging their traditional way of life as the covenanted people of God, who had been called out of Egypt through their cry to be the people of God, to live together justly, humanely by this covenant. In the time of John's writing, you have approximately 70 to 90% of the population who lived on the edge of destitution. Because when Rome moved in, they taxed or maybe imposed tribute on foreign subjects. And so the people here who had been conquered, the Jewish people, and especially the Galileans, those in the countryside, were subject to this Roman tax with the military backing it up, and it was a heavy, heavy tax. But what's significant for us here today is not just the Roman tax on them. So there's the foreign tax that they all have to pay. They have to give their food surpluses over to Rome. But there's also then a domestic tax. And the domestic tax comes through and for the temple. This is where my thinking in reading the Bible has changed so much over the years. Because I see now the political role that the temple played in first century Palestine. Yes, it was a religious center, but temples often emerged in cities as they sprung up and in empires to provide ideological justification for the imperial pursuits of the area. And unfortunately, this at this point was not that much different. What you have here in the time of John's writing is a temple aristocracy, a priestly aristocracy, a people who lived significantly better than the people through the taxes that were paid to them, all backed up by the law. And so you have the priests, and then you have the scribes, the interpreters of this law. You have the Pharisees creating different laws. They have their differences, yes, but they also help aid and support one another. And it's the people who suffered. So the people are expected to pay both a foreign tax to Rome, but also a temple tax, and to make their annual pilgrimage into Jerusalem. Jerusalem is not on any major trading routes. It's about 3,000 feet up. It's quite a trek. The only reason to go there annually for the people is a religious pilgrimage, but it's also a mandated pilgrimage to bring your taxes, your tithes. Now, what happens if you have a bad crop one year, if drought passes through, as often did? Most of the people in the surrounding rural areas were just one bad year from not being able to pay. If they don't pay, they're then labeled sinners. Sinners in the Gospels is not sin in the way that we've come to think of it here. It's a social designation. It's a class thing. It's those who could not afford to pay and therefore live by the law in the way that they were mandated to. And so there's all these sinners around who cannot pay their taxes. If they have a especially bad year and they can't pay, then they have to take out loans. But what then if they can't pay those loans? Then larger landowners come and will buy their lands from them. They'll lose their family land that they've been taking care of for a long time. It's taken away from them, and they become tenant farmers. They then maybe become day laborers in a very competitive environment, struggling to find work day to day. And then maybe after that, if they can't make it, if they can't find work, sell themselves off into slavery. Struggle with malnutrition, disease. It was this quick of a slide, this slippery of a slope for those around Palestine, especially those outside of the city center. And so this is the context. In John's gospel, when we hear the Jews, he's talking about the Judeans. It is a people who benefit from this arrangement. It is an aristocratic elite in the center of the city, local rulers who have made some arrangements with Rome, who are able to benefit through this arrangement with the people as the people struggle to survive. And so here in John's gospel, you have a man sent from God whose name was John. We're already keyed in that John is a messenger here of God. And parallel that, in opposition to that, we have the priests and the Levites who are sent from Jerusalem, from the Judeans, this class. And what are they sent to ask John? Who are you? Who do you think that you are? What are you doing out here? So we have the Judeans pit against the ministry of John. Now we see at the end of the text, the writer John likes to wait until the end of his stories to key us into some important information. But it says, this took place in Bethany across the Jordan where John was baptizing. Across the Jordan means it's not the Bethany that we think of right next to Jerusalem. This is probably a good 15 to 20 miles outside of Jerusalem. Across the Jordan, maybe in the plains area out there. So this would have been at least a day's walk for the people who came out there to question him. So they had serious questions. So they go out there and ask, who are you? And he confesses to them and did not deny it, but confessed, I am not the Messiah. And then they ask them, what then? Are you Elijah? He says, I am not. Are you the prophet? He answered, no. Then they said to him, well then, who are you? Give us an answer. We have to report back. We just journeyed for a day to talk to you and figure out what's going on out here. The Messiah, okay, we might think you're a little crazy, but we get that. We can work with that. Elijah, some say maybe you're Elijah. Just a prophet, someone who thinks that he's going to come and redeem Israel, as all of these are. But John says no to all of them. And so now they're stuck. They have to figure out who he is. One question for me as I read this is, what is the concern? What is the threat that John poses? This obscure figure out in the wilderness, a good 15 to 20 miles away from the city center of Jerusalem. So the text continues. John says, I am the voice of one crying out in the wilderness, make straight the ways of the Lord, as the prophet Isaiah said. Now they had been sent from the Pharisees, and they asked him, why then are you baptizing if you are neither the Messiah, nor Elijah, nor the prophet? Why then are you baptizing? With baptism, I think we start to get at the heart of the anxiety amongst the religious aristocracy that has sent these spies, these questioners, out to John in the wilderness. The baptism at this time period was an act of God that was authorized by the temple. It is a sacred act. It is, in baptism, you have the authority to lead somebody into a way of life, to socialize somebody. Baptism is an act of being bound with the community. And so it's also then a legal act. John is not within here the jurisdiction of the temple. He's across the Jordan. He's not within the original promised land. And he's gathering up these people and he's acting on behalf of God. He's claiming, there's a claim that he is sent by God. And so he is baptizing people into a way of life that is outside the jurisdiction, the authority, the law of the temple. And what is the significance of this law? What I want to argue today, and as then I want to connect it to our time and place today, is that what the people there, the Judeans, the people around, were baptized into through the temple, through the law, by the aristocracy of that time period, is that they were baptized into silencing. There's plenty of people who benefited in Jerusalem from the existence of the temple. a lot of people who were not the top aristocracy, but nevertheless, they got jobs to the temple. They didn't have to worry about living day to day. They received their livelihood. And so in baptism and being baptized into this arrangement, they came to accept things the way they were. They accepted things as a given and an inevitability, maybe something that was even eternal. It's just always going to be this way. Now, the people of the countryside, if they're baptized into this, they may not like it. They might not like that two-fifths, three-fifths of their income is going to these taxes, much of it to the temple. But nevertheless, it's just the way things are. From the time they were babies, this is the arrangement that they've been a part of, and there's just not much that you can do about it. John is giving them another option. John is offering an alternative baptism out in the wilderness, outside of this jurisdiction. And he says, "I am the voice of one crying out in the wilderness, make straight the way of the Lord." John echoes here the language that we find in the Bible very early on in the Exodus, where the people were groaning under the weight of their oppression by the Egyptian rulers, and they began to cry out. Their silence was broken, and they cried out. John here is breaking the silencing of the arrangement that is occurring in this time, in this place. He's leading people into a space where they can begin to see differently, imagine differently, where they can start to recognize the ways that they themselves have been silenced internally, where they can give voice to the groans that have been occurring within them for some time, and they can vocalize it, they can cry out, and in so doing, they begin to make a way for the Messiah, the long-awaited ruler, leader, who would redeem Israel, who would lead them into liberated communities where the humanity of all was embraced. And so this is the issue that I see at play here. By taking on the authority of God and baptizing people with water out in the wilderness, away from the temple center, outside of the jurisdiction of the priests, the scribes, the Pharisees, John is threatening the entire order. Because when people live in a context where law is so prevalent, is so emphasized, that becomes internalized in their bodies. And so to break it, you first need a bodily cry. To touch your own experience again. To feel the weight of that which is upon you. To cry out so God will hear their cries, that a path may be opened up. And with that, these institutions become threatened, because then the people see. Then the people act out of their experience. Then the people can name things and begin to confront it. So baptism can be an act of silencing. It can be an act of getting us to go along with the way things are. Baptism can also be an act of leading us into a counter imagination, a different experience that connects us with our own experience and causes us to cry out. I started today with a bit, just a short testimony of this past year. I would say that what I have experienced at this church over the past 7 years or so now has been nothing less than the sort of baptism that we're hearing John offering to the people. It is a baptism that, even if it takes some time, leads people deeply into their own experience and causes them to cry out. This is the way that I have been alienated. This is the way that I experience or participate within oppression. This is what we're doing, sisters and brothers, every time we offer our testimonies before the congregation. If we testify fully, then we're offering ourselves fully, and we're offering this sort of cry. When you have a colonial arrangement. When you have a history of subjugating, oppressing some people, and then other people experiencing some of the benefits of it and being baptized into silence, then nothing, with this silencing, nothing changes. The way that I interpret my own experience now as a white male growing up in this country, in the church, and evangelical Christianity, and Lutheran Christianity, and mainline Christianity, is that there is a lot of silencing that is going on. A lot of silencing. Part of what it means to be raised white now in this country, especially, or to be drawn into whiteness, is that through the law, through doing religion well, through doing our jobs well, through following law and order, we are drawn into silencing. We are the Judeans here. We are the Judeans who are close enough to the temple, who can reap some of the fruit, and for whom it would be inconvenient to say anything other. And so we just carry along. And in that, we maintain some sort of illusion of goodness, of innocence, of being cleansed, of being pure, and we carry on. What does innocence look like in this context for the Judeans? What does that mean? If they're benefiting off the fruits and the labors and the demonization and the criminalizing of the cities out there of those people who cannot pay their temple tax, what does that mean? So John draws them out to see differently, to hear differently. In this country now, since I think it was 64, with Barry Goldwater and his presidential run, we have had the rhetoric of law and order stronger than ever. We've always emphasized law in this country. But with Goldwater, and then through Nixon, and then through Reagan, and then in the 80s, and the war on drugs, and the rise of mass incarceration, and now police militarization, this emphasis on law and order has become stronger than ever. We've talked about this. We've engaged Michelle Alexander, her work in the new Jim Crow. We've talked about mass incarceration. We've talked about the white supremacy that undergirds it. What I'm arguing today is that as we look at this text and we look at the experience of the Judeans, all of us are socialized into this to some degree. The sinners of John's time period, those who are deemed sinners because they cannot pay because of an unjust system that exploits them, are the criminals of today. The black males in our inner cities, those who have been crying out and we have not listened. We have not heard, we have not seen, because we have been so deeply socialized, baptized into this larger system where the air that we breathe is white supremacy, and so we don't even see it. We don't see it, we don't feel it. And we maintain some sort of illusion of innocence through it all. John is inviting the people into an alternative space to cry out. I think there are examples of this sort of cry going on all around us today. Just yesterday, there was the march of thousands in New York and cities around this country crying out, "Black Lives Matter. Black Lives Matter. Black Lives Matter." We're seeing the videos now. This has been going on for a long time with the police, but now we get to see the videos of it. And people are beginning to be woken up a bit. And there is a new generation that is emerging that is leading a new movement out in the wilderness, crying out and preparing the way for messianic communities of peace and justice and human flourishing where all are adopted and included into that. There is this cry that is emerging all around us. This cry that is emerging in a country that has never dealt with the fruit, the legacy of its past, of colonization, of slavery, of Jim Crow. It's just found new ways to do it that remain invisible now. But we're all wrapped up in this. I
I am the voice of one crying out in the wilderness, make way the straight of the Lord. Make straight the way of the Lord. And so John says, I baptize with water. Among you stands one who you do not know, the one who is coming after me. I am not worthy to untie the thong of his sandal. This took place in Bethany across the Jordan where John was baptizing. There are a lot of these cries happening globally right now and in this country. This is one of them, and this is an important one, a new movement that is emerging in our midst. For a long time, we've had the cry of third world debt relief because those same predatory practices have been done to countries around the globe, but especially countries in Africa and in South America, where loans or tribute has been imposed on these people. We have the cry of the environment right now, and we have the cry of indigenous peoples who have continued to groan and to suffer under the weight of this oppression. The question that John text confronts us with today is, can we hear those voices that are trying to make a more straight way? Dietrich Bonhoeffer, he asked the question, who is Christ for us today? And the reason that he's so influential for me and for this community, and what I really draw from him, is that he doesn't think of Christ just as this figure in the past or this person who will come back someday. That is all true. We profess that in our faith. But Christ, the Messiah, is also a social reality. It is a reality of redeemed communities that learn to see the humanity in one another, to treat each other humanely, that learn to connect again with the earth and to treat the earth well. It is communities that overcome our alienation, our oppression of one another, that learn to confess that, and so confessing that, live liberated. Brothers and sisters, our call today is not to be the Messiah. Our call is to release the cry, to cry out in the wilderness, or to listen to those who are already doing it and to join them, to follow. For myself, my call is to find others who are already crying out and to humbly listen and follow. I see these movements emerging. I see this Black Lives Matter movement, this new civil rights movement that is emerging here. I can listen and I can learn from these cries. I can begin to see the way I myself experience alienation as a beneficiary in a lot of ways of this larger system that we're a part of, but also how I suffer from it, and I can testify to that, and then I can listen and follow. So too, our community, as I said, we've done this and we continue to do this. The role of our community is to be this sort of wilderness space that John is talking about. To be far enough removed from officialdom, the larger religious and denominational system. Yes, we're a part of it, we serve it, but we also step back to see how religion functions in this country. And we seek to read the Bible differently, to interpret ourselves differently, and to start to create a way for that messianic community to emerge in the future, create a way for future generations to live differently than we have, to make the way straight for the coming of the messianic community that overcomes colonization in our midst. In light of our discussions this year, I would say that can advocate for, hope for, pray for in the future for the return of land to native peoples, for the giving of reparations for stolen labor, for the upending of hierarchies, of policing and militarization of Black communities, that learns to reconnect with the land, to live simply and sustainably, that learns to relate through gift and reciprocity rather than through exchange and commodification of relationships, that finds identity in relationships rather than in production and consumption, as we are socialized and baptized into constantly through the advertising and the media all around us. Brothers and sisters, we have the chance to also be that voice crying out in the wilderness, to draw in people like me so that I can also learn to break through the silencing, to break through the sort of rationalism and the detachment that I have been schooled into, so that I can cry with you and that I can cry out of my own experience, that I can touch it, name it, and therefore become a part of the larger human community. I'm really grateful, as I said at the beginning, to be here. I can feel in my body that I still have a long ways to go in this, to journey with you in this message. There are so many of you here who are my mentors, who have taught me and lead me and continue to draw me forward, who help me or who cry for me and who cry for others. But my desire is to be one who can also draw others into that and to open up the path, to make a straight way for future generations. We're not here for ourselves. We're here for those who will follow us. This is something that I have learned from the Native communities over this past year, who think 7 generations ahead. What will this world be like then? Can we hope for, can we cry out for something different? So, I just want to close with thank you. I love you all. I'm very grateful for this community, and I'm grateful to be able to share with you again. Let's pray.